Mr. Drake.
Grail 3. Right, Mr. Drake, you mentioned that you got married. When was that?
When I was 31. That was 31 and 13. That would be 34.
And can you talk a little bit about your wife?
Yes,
where she was from?
A wonderful girl. She lost her mother when she was 15. And then, of course, when we were all pals together, there was quite a gang of us. We used to meet up at night time and have walks and things like that, and probably on a Sunday afternoon. And we eventually got married, and although she hadn't a mother, she was brought up with a grandmother who had a corner shop, similar to what you see on the television, a corner shop which supplied everything, and that was down in the south end of the town, of Ensworth Grove Avenue, and we managed to rent a house which was only 1, 2, 3 doors away from the shop, so it was very handy. The wife used to help in the shop with her grandmother, and so she carried on there, and we had a couple of children, Joe and Donald, and we still lived there, and the grandmother eventually gave the shop up, and one of the daughters took it over. So then we moved into another address, which was closer to town, and we lived there until I was finally called up for service.
So you had two children before the war started?
I had two children before the war, two lads, and they were going to a local school. Not the one I went to, but to the school near there, because this was in the south end of the town. It was only a 2 minute walk, so they were handy for that particular school. And they remained there for the duration of the war.
Now, you got married. Could you live when you had two children and what to support and so on? Do you think you were well off at this stage?
Well, we weren't short of anything, I'll put it that way. I wouldn't say we were well off, but I had a decent job. As I said, it was a good wage on the lorry driving. So we weren't asking anybody for anything, and we were managing quite well, and rent was only about 8 shillings a week on the property, so in Grove Avenue. So we were quite comfortable in bringing the kids up. And on the whole, there was nothing to grumble about. We could go to the cinema when we wanted to, and in general, we were having quite a decent life together. When I ceased to, I put in for a local job driving for the council, which I thought would be better than the long distance job, and the money would be round about the same, probably a bit less, but at least I'd be at home a lot more. So I applied for this job on the council, and I got the job, so then I was driving for the local council.
And what did that entail? Going
around and emptying all the dustbins. At least they had plenty of time off, which I'd never experienced before, with a long distance type of work.
So what would be the hours on this new job?
Oh, we just started at 7:30 and you finished at 4:30. So then we had quite a bit of time together and we could indulge in his tennis and things like that. So
you mentioned the cinema. Were you a fan of the cinema at this stage?
Yes, we used to go very often on the Saturday night. Very often go to the cinema, or especially in winter, and it was called the Hippodrome, and they used to put local shows on, the local operatic society, which my wife was a member, and so they used to once a year always put one of either the Mikado or one of the other light operas. Used to practice for it and give a show, and it was always well supported.
Now, as the 30s progressed, you'd moved into this new job. That was just about 6 months before the war, you said earlier.
Yes, sir.
Now, in this phase of like the late 30s, had you any? You talked earlier about the foreman who suggested that because they were stockpiling chocolate, the war was gonna be a war.
Yeah.
What were your own feelings about what was coming up?
Realised that at this time now that after taking this new job, we realised that war was could happen, and I joined the local volunteers for service locally. Trying to think what they called it now. You've learned all about gases and things like this when you went to the meetings, and what will you do, and the types of gases that could be used, and how to be prepared for any type. And
were these formal classes that they would teach you?
Yes, those instructors came to teach you all about them. It was not the local defence volunteers.
Could it be the militia?
It was militia. It was what they formed themselves to be on duty if a man were declared.
And so, how many meetings would they have with this?
Probably one a week.
And did you wear a uniform?
No, I didn't wear a uniform. I just wore what your own clothing.
And was there any kind of firearms drill, anything like that?
No, there were no firearms drill. It was all the technical stuff on what could happen. Gas and things like that.
So it was a kind of civil defence?
Civil defence.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Defence volunteer.
Do you think people was that the biggest concern for people, would be air attack and gas and so on?
Yeah, they were very much concerned because they soon issued everybody with gas masks. So it was a scare at the for the time being, that nobody knew what type of warfare we were going to go into at that stage.
Now, do you have any memories of Neville Chamberlain and his kind of peace pact?
Yes, I remember him reading that piece of paper.
What did you think of that?
I've always regarded it as being, he did a very good job. for one reason. He knew it was going to come, so he put it off for 12 months. And that 12 months, I think, was very, very bad. Because during that 12 months, they got all the armament factories going and they got started producing war materials and things like that. Airplanes and all the factories started turning over from what they were doing to building tanks and all war materials. So I thought, on the whole, when we look back on it, I think he did a very good job in postponing it, although it was to the detriment of some of the countries in Europe. It was to the benefit of ourselves that we managed to put it off for 12 months.
What did you think about it at the time, in 1938?
It was.
Did you think the war had been... That was the end of it, the worst period of time.
I thought it would come eventually because we knew in this anonymous south that we'd have to be stopped with this Hitler. There was no doubt about that. The way of performing and the fanatical way he was doing it. Well, I knew at some stage he'd have to be stopped, otherwise his ambition was that he was going to rule everybody. So, even in them days, I knew that it would come to war because of the facts as we saw them. And so, of course, eventually, 12 months after Chamberlain read his little piece of paper of peace, up from the war.
What can you remember about that day?
I can well remember about that because I was in Blackpool at the time on holiday with my wife and two kids. And we were going back the day war was declared. That was the end of the holiday. We had a week in Blackpool. And I always remember driving back and we got back on the Saturday night or Sunday morning, and all the sirens went on the Sunday, so we definitely knew we were in the war. We didn't hear any planes or anything, but for some unknown reason, all the sirens went, and so that's it. And of course, we learned that I'd learned in Blackpool that the war had been declared. The people coming in that week, people were coming in even before war was declared. There were people coming in from London, kiddies, and that floating into Blackpool, away from the London area, where they knew if once it started, would be eventually bombed. And of course, from all the big cities. Taken in all over the place. My sister had two stay with her in Huddersfield. There was a general influx of coaches coming in with salesmen and sorting the places where they were going to stay.
What was the general mood on this day? The people that you were with for yourself? And
well, they were all, although we knew it was coming, they were all sick to death. There was no happiness anywhere. It was a real distress signal when war was declared. So there was nobody running about with a smiling face in them days. It was all serious business.
Now, you were a married man now with two children.
Yeah.
And how did you... What did you think then about what your possible role in the war effort would be? Had you any ambitions to... What did you want?
I had no ambitions. I didn't have any ambitions. I always believed in taking life as it comes. And it will sort itself out. So, I haven't any particular ambitions. The war hadn't been going on all that long, of course, when I got my calling up papers. And of course, it was up to Edinburgh, joining up in the 16th DLI, forming the 16th DLI, more or less were all officers were from the Beds and Earths.
Now, we'll get to that, but at this stage, you've just been annulled at Blackpool, war's been declared.
Yeah.
Now, you volunteered earlier for this civil defence.
Yeah.
Training.
Yeah.
Was that in Hemsworth itself?
Yes, that was in Hemsworth.
So that was a local. And who were the who were the instructors who were teaching you? Were they kind of regular?
They usually come regular to the meetings. I didn't know them otherwise. They weren't local people, but they were come to train people in civil defence.
But they weren't army or
no.
They were just civilians themselves.
They were civilians, yes.
And you'd have had to register for call of. Could you describe that?
And I don't recall any particular register. I believe they inquired of your bosses, and although I had a HGB license, which I'd taken a test for, and I had to have that when I was on the lorries, which I went into the Yorkshire Traffic Commissioners and passed my test on a heavy goods vehicle. So I had a heavy goods vehicle license, so in some ways I thought I wouldn't be called up. However, my calling up papers come and I had to go.
So what was actually in your the letter, the envelope?
I didn't know what was going to happen after that. I didn't know anything about the army particularly, and so it was all going to be another experience for me.
And so you got your calling up papers. Did they say? Did they tell you where you had to go? And
yeah, they tell us where to go. To get a certain train and up to Edinburgh, and then those army vehicles waiting to pick you up. We all went into the vehicles and in the back of the vehicles and flourished the road. We canvassed Oxford and went up to Froxton Road, which was about 4 or 5 miles outside on the outskirts of Edinburgh, on the south side, and there were tents. So we had to pick his own palliasse up and fill it with straw and put his bed down in one of the tents. So there were so many of them, about a dozen in each tent. And that was going to be. That was the start. However, it was very inclement weather. They called it Scots mist, but I called it rain. Because it rained for a fortnight, it never seemed to stop. And the field was like a quagmire. So we were still in a civilian clothing. They hadn't got enough to go around when its clothing did come, so those quite a few were awkward to fit that couldn't get the army clothing, and believe me, after a fortnight in them conditions, then you're damn glad to get the army clothes on. And of course, you weren't allowed out in civilian clothing. You'd have to have army clothing to go out, and you wouldn't allow you out in civilian clothing, so we were all dying to get his army clobber on and feel a bit warmer at least than
Now, you came up on this train, was that a special train?
I don't know whether it was special or not. There was quite a lot on it. I suppose it could have been, but I don't know whether it was a special train, but it was. We had to go down to the local train depot, which was on the main London North Eastern Railway system, and the station. And we got on there and we went straight through to Edinburgh.
Did you know?
They picked army personnel up. On the way up, I don't know, but quite a few were getting on and off from different places.
Did you know anybody else that it was that it got?
Yeah, there was one lad who worked on the council with me, and he was on the same chat. But once we got to Edinburgh, he didn't seem to stay long. He seemed to move to somewhere else, and so I never had a lot of contact with him. Only for the first fortnight or 3 weeks. They seemed to move him on to another regiment or something.
Now, when you were called up, did it actually say that you were going to the Durham Light Infantry?
Yeah, yeah.
And what did you think of that?
Well, I didn't know anything about it, really, and so that we'll find out when we get there.
So you didn't have any prior knowledge of this regiment?
No, I had no prior knowledge of the regiment, but I wasn't an enthusiast, as you might say.
And you weren't surprised that you hadn't been drafted to one of the Yorkshire? Did you feel anything about that?
I had no idea, really. I just accepted it, which I thought I had to in any case. And I realised it was a Northern regiment rather than the King's Own Yorkshire regiment, which is more or less on the same par as the Durham Light Infantry. But I understood it was, when I got there and got to know a little bit more about it, I understand it had a very good reputation. So I was quite happy being in it. And,
were you happy with it, just generally, with the Army as opposed to the Navy or the Air Force? Had you expressed any preference?
No, I didn't expect any preference. I just, like I said, I hadn't any particular ambitions at that time. I thought whatever comes along, I'll accept, and that's what I did.
What did your wife think about you being called up?
Well, of course, they disappointed, you know, and it's a heartbreaking experience. And it would prove a more heartbreaking experience when nobody got any leave for 6 months, so it was a matter of corresponding by letter, and that's all we had. Even the finishing of the training period, which was about 3 months, nobody got any leave. It was only until after 6 months that anybody got on leave.
Now, just focusing on this first couple of weeks,
yeah.
You get up to Edinburgh, you get off the train, you get in these trucks, you arrive in this set of tents in a field.
Yeah.
What was your routine during these 2 weeks?
Well, like I said, we couldn't do any drilling because the field was like a quagmire. So there was generally illustrating and things like that, but they took the opportunity. There was a big marquee put up for the medical officer, so he took the opportunity of just the first 2 weeks of giving us all jabs in the arm. We had about 5 different bots all pumped into us within them first 2 weeks. So it wasn't a very, very pleasant 2 weeks. A lot more out of wild. He finished up with his marquee full of invalids coming round after the injections we'd had for malaria and all these type of illnesses which you're likely to get when you go abroad. So the first fortnight was really, we were engulfed in getting these, he was engulfed in getting all these inoculations done. And of course, they had to wait so many hours before they could give you another one, and say 3 days sometimes before they could carry on with the next one. So we were parading into the MO's, excuse me, into the MO's marquee. I always remember that there was one bloke out of our tent, a bit tall, thin lad, and he was, every time the oddly got hold of his arm, he used to faint, and he used to go down onto the floor, but he used to follow him down, still put it in.
So you were still in civilian clothes while all of this was going on?
Yes, yes.
So what else were they, trying
well,
to
do? Well, then they got, the army issues came up then, and we were sorting out as clothing and things like that. So we eventually all got in army uniform. You were just an odd one or two, but there were very few privateers. We all finished up with this army uniform.
And what did you think of the army uniform at this?
This particular time, I
did it fit?
I had a lot of enthusiasm, except that I used to look at the daily orders and what we're going to go with, which we do the next day, and I was always keen on doing things right. And so that's when I say it got me into trouble, because the NCO that we had, the corporal, who used to take us on drill, we'd been drilling during the day, and when I looked up the orders, I found out he'd been doing it the wrong way. So I checked over on the notice board and checked it through, and well, that's what me and taught us that way. And he happened to be stood behind us, and of course I turned around and told him. And unbeknownst to me, the sergeant major, which was Gates, he was the company sergeant major of A Company, and did he lay to me? What do you mean talking to a corporal and superior officer like that? He said, get your back on and three times round the field. Ooh, sweat rolled out of me, and I was very careful what I spoke to any officer there, whether it be a lance corporal, corporal, or sergeant or sergeant major. But I didn't get into any more trouble. I was dedicated to do what I had to do, and that was the main part of it. But,
can you remember what the corporal was doing wrong specifically with the drill?
I remember it, but I can't think of his name.
Now, you were in tents. Can you remember any of the men that we were with in the tent and where they were from and what kind of men they were?
No, only this particular lad who came up from the same village. And like I said, I never realised what happened to him, because he suddenly disappeared. And whether he went to another regiment or not or something, I don't know, whether he applied, if he had a brother in another regiment, and he tried to do that. But he weren't there long, and so they were all strangers. And of course you made your own friends, or if you could call them friends, really, they're all acquaintances which you've met. You're all in the same boat, sort of thing.
And where were these men from?
From different parts. There was two from Birmingham area, two pals. They were pals, so they came in together and were pals all the way through. There was this tall lad which said he always used to paint us, as soon as he saw the needle coming, and mother had a window cleaner from Leeds, and he